You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It began with the transistor radio. When Akio Morita released the first model in 1955, no one in Asia, and certainly not in the West, realized the impact that Sony would have in the next 50 years, along with other Asian companies like Matsushita, Hyundai, Lenovo, and Daewoo, plus a slew of anonymous Asian manufacturing plants, call centers, and IT companies, driven by determined, hard-working leaders and entrepreneurs. Joining me now is Michael Schumann. He's been a business journalist in Asia for more than 10 years, where before he became a writer for Time magazine, he wrote for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of The Miracle, the epic story of Asia's quest for wealth. It's published by Harper Business. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Hi, thanks.
You live in Hong Kong. Has it changed much since you first moved there?
The great thing about Hong Kong, actually, is that there were a lot of worries about Hong Kong about a decade ago, that when Hong Kong got returned to China, that it was going to go through all these dramatic changes. But it's actually found all kinds of new resilience because of its greater and greater contact with China. And it's because of that the city's really been thriving.
Because it now can act as a middleman with mainland China, with the People's Republic of China. Right. It did in the past, but it was a more complicated transaction.
Well, the other thing that Hong Kong has done especially well is that it's very much capitalized on its expertise in finance. And there was all these worries that Shanghai was going to become the finance center for China, and actually that may happen somewhere down the road. But right now, Hong Kong still has such clear advantages and expertise that it's really solidified its role as the premier finance city in East Asia, and especially for China.
So has Beijing just simply allowed the people who are already doing business to continue working the way they did, or have they tried to influence the way they do business?
Beijing has been extremely smart in realizing that the kind of management expertise, financial expertise that you have in Hong Kong could really benefit China and benefit the reform process in China, and have very smartly taken advantage of it rather than trying to change it.
Have you lived elsewhere in Asia?
Yes, I spent almost 5 years in Seoul, South Korea, which was my first post, and then I spent 2 years bouncing back and forth between Singapore and Jakarta in Indonesia.
Now, those are all countries that came on board as Asia changed, but Japan was the first?
Japan was the first.
And it was the one that I would have thought would have had the hardest time because it had been devastated by World War II.
Japan, though, was the only country in Asia that had an experience of industrialization before World War II, as we found out during the war, that they actually became quite advanced in their manufacturing and technology and could really compete with Europe in that way. But yes, they were their entire economy, and especially the industrial economy, was more or less destroyed during the war. So there was a bit of a starting over element.
Although they had started from scratch during the Meiji period,
yes.
and developed very quickly. So I guess there was that sense they could just do it again.
There's a sense that they could do it again. They already had some proven policies that had helped in the past. They kind of dusted off and altered and changed for a more modern era. But it was also, I think, after the war, there was a tremendous amount of determination to restore the economy and to raise even higher levels than they were at before.
What is METI?
METI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, it was one of the most influential government organizations and played a very, very key role in guiding the economy and guiding the changes that the economy went through tools, through basically industrial policy, which was targeting certain industries for special support.
So the government really played a role in how Japan developed. In this country, there'd be a lot of resistance to that sort of thing.
The government played a tremendously influential role in several countries in Asia, and a lot of them learned it from Japan. Japan was kind of the testing ground for the idea that how you can use a state to develop an economy very, very quickly. The Japanese are really at the center of that idea, and then it was copied in places like Korea and Taiwan, with also great success. But because of the nature of industrial policy, it demanded a type of government intervention that the United States would be unacceptable, or at least very difficult.
In Japan, I don't know whether you consider Japan a democracy or not, because it's had pretty much one-party rule until recently. It looks like the ruling party, finally, Liberal Democrats, are finally going to be voted out of office for the second time since World War II.
It's possible, but I think Japan now, Japan has been in a very stagnant economic state now for going on 20 years.
Although they just said they just turned the corner.
They just turned the corner, but for Japan turning the corner, it means, you know, Japan has fallen in and out of recession since the early 1990s, and it's a country that very much needs dramatic economic reform, and I think a change of government may do them some good.
Yeah, that's interesting because Japan, right, still is a leader in all sorts of areas.
Yes.
Toyota and Honda are major figures in the automotive industry. Toyota now is it the largest automotive company?
It is the largest automotive company in the world.
And we still look to Sony and Matsushita and some of the others for all of our electronics. Why has it had so much trouble then?
It's interesting. Japan set in place an economic structure that was tremendously successful in building rapid growth back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But since then, that system has needed reform, and it hasn't taken place. What the United States has done so well, if you remember, in the 80s, there was a lot of journalists and books that talking about how the U.S. was in decline, that Japan was basically going to beat out the U.S. in global economic competition. That didn't happen. Well, why didn't it happen? It didn't happen because the U.S. economy has proven surprisingly and amazingly adept at reinventing itself and innovating. Japan hasn't really been very successful at that. And it's because the economic system that's put in place has proven inflexible. These companies like Sony still do very well, but you haven't seen new ideas, new companies, new industries surface in Japan to continue that kind of rapid growth in the way that you have in the United States, despite this current recession. The U.S. has been tremendously successful in the last 20 years at developing new industries.
Is that because of economic policy, or is it just because the cultures are different?
I think a lot of it is because of the policies that the countries have in place. You know, there's great benefits to the U.S. system, which really fosters and encourages entrepreneurship and risk-taking in a way that the Japanese system does not. It's still a very bureaucratic-led economy, and the bureaucracy has proven very resistant to change.
There's also, is it called Keiretsu?
Keiretsu, yes.
Which is where there are certain families that kind of dominate the Japanese economy, and it's hard for new people to come up with things.
It's hard for new
companies. Which is weird because after World War II, it was all about new.
It was all about entrepreneurship and new ideas. But these big companies have gotten very, very entrenched. The system under which they work has gotten very entrenched. The financial system operates in certain ways. It makes it very difficult for new entrepreneurs to rise through the system to develop new companies and new ideas.
It's interesting that the United States has come up with new ideas. We are a democracy. Most of the countries that have done really well in Asia have been authoritarian to varying degrees.
Had been, yes. I mean,
they've gone through some changes.
Yeah, it's a little bit startling.
And the greatest democracy of all was very late to come on board.
Well, it was very, very common thinking and continues to be common thinking when looking at Asia that there was a direct link between authoritarian regimes and high growth, because going back to the 50s, 60s, just about every place that experienced a big rapid boom was an authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regime or some kind of one, as you said, one-party state in Japan. I actually, though, don't kind of buy into that idea because a country like India, which is one of the world's great democracies, one of the most fractured democracies, can compete with any of these countries in terms of record of economic growth once they started their economic reform program. And you have countries like South Korea that continued to excel after their democratization process. So I think what's important to look at in these countries and what they did very well is that they built a consensus behind certain policies to produce rapid growth. And that can happen in a democracy like the United States as well. And that can happen in dictatorships as well, but that consensus and that direction in policy is more important than the underlying government system.
My guest is Michael Schumann, whose book, The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, is published by Harper Business. Didn't different companies use foreign wealth and technology in different ways?
Yeah, see, that's actually a very kind of underplayed aspect of the story, the influence that foreign firms have had on Asia's rise. and especially American companies. American companies were very aggressive in licensing technology, in investing and providing capital, and in outsourcing, in buying things from Asian companies, hiring Asian companies to manufacture for them, offshoring, moving factories to Asia. The role that the American multinational has played in Asia's rise is tremendously important.
What about the role that Japan has played? Because didn't they open up satellite companies everywhere?
Yes.
Now, of course, there are an awful lot of American manufacturers that are owned by the Japanese, yeah, and being run by the Japanese.
The Japanese played actually a similar role, of course, later than the United States, but a very similar role, especially in Southeast Asia. When you look at the numbers out of Southeast Asia in terms of foreign investment going back to, let's say, the 1980s, the Japanese were incredibly dominant. You had rising costs within Japan that caused Japanese companies to move their production offshore in the same way American companies were.
We talked about governments giving preference to certain industries and companies, right, rather than others. That seemed to work in some cases and not in others. Didn't it really have a negative effect in Indonesia,
yeah,
for example?
That was one of the big questions that I struggled with when writing this book. Why did some state-backed efforts succeed so incredibly well in places like Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan? And why did others just kind of flop terribly? And I think the difference was that the state-backed companies and enterprises that were successful, especially in a place like South Korea, were basically forced to perform. There was an element of discipline, in some cases, provided by the market. These companies were not supposed to be big, bloated state companies. They were supposed to go out in the world and compete with American, European firms and make a product that could sell. And that kind of discipline and force them to be inventive and productive and efficient, even though they were backed by the state. The problem is that some other countries in Asia, you mentioned Indonesia, which is probably the best example, took the idea of kind of targeting industries and then left out that important element where, okay, you got to make profits, you got to perform, otherwise you're not going to continue to get help. And without that element, these state-backed companies tended to flounder.
And so what happened is we have these powerful groups that didn't succeed, and
right,
that led to the end of the Asian bubble,
yeah,
didn't it?
What happened in the Asian financial crisis, and it happened in Indonesia, it happened in Korea and Malaysia, you had a situation where companies had become too debt-ridden, too bloated. The financial systems had an idea that certain companies were basically too big to fail, and these companies were allowed to borrow money.
Gee, this sounds so American,
yeah,
doesn't it?
sounds oddly familiar, doesn't it? And what happened when these countries got hit by a big international shock, which was a loss of confidence among international investors in these economies, it was basically a house of cards and collapse. So some of the lessons that even like a South Korea had learned early on in terms of forcing companies to perform, making sure companies were really successful, had kind of also wavered in the later years of, you know, by the 1990s, and they allowed their companies to become bloated and less efficient.
Do you ever wonder why Americans didn't notice that we were following a similar path?
It's interesting. I think there's great lessons actually looking at in Asia's experience for what's going on here in the United States, especially in terms of, as you mentioned, state-backed companies. General Motors is now a state-backed company, and it's been bailed out. And I think looking at Asia, Washington has to realize that GM has to be forced to perform in return for state help. That this can't be an open-ended blank check kind of situation. Otherwise, things will never really right themselves. That's a mistake that, as I said, other Asian countries made, and the Asian countries that were very successful in backing companies didn't make that mistake.
It is interesting that Ford, which refused to take government help,
right,
is the one that looks most likely to turn the corner,
right,
first.
Right. It's also, I think, looking at Asia, the state role, in my opinion, has been a little bit overblown. You're not looking at Soviet style command economies. You're not looking at economies that were dominated by the state. You're looking at economies that were generally private, and the government played a supporting role, not in most cases a direct ownership and controlling role. And this is really an economic boom, an economic miracle that was driven primarily by free enterprise and private entrepreneurship.
And that leads us to China, which we will talk about when we come back. My guest is Michael Schumann, who is the Asia business correspondent for Time magazine, covers the entire continent from India to Japan. He also spent more than 6 years as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in South Korea and Indonesia. He was part of an award-winning team of journalists who covered the 1997-1998 Asian economic crisis for the Wall Street Journal. His book, The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, is published by Harper Business. We will continue after this. My guest is Michael Schumann. His book, The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, it's published by Harper Business. How did other countries build off the first wave of what you call Asian tigers? Well, I mean, we don't hear a lot about other industrializing countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore, even though they also had great successes, didn't they?
What's fascinating about Asia is kind of the self-generating quality of the economic boom. It started in Japan, in Korea, in Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, and eventually spread through Southeast Asia and then eventually to India. And there was a lot of copycatting going on. The former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, is very, very open about the idea that when he was trying to figure out what to do in Malaysia, that he looked specifically at Japan and Korea and said, hey, you know, we need to do what they're doing.
Except that he had a big difference there. He had ethnic minorities and other problems to contend with. And he also is not, well, judging from other things he's done, he's not the most stable person to be running a country.
He's an interesting character. I had the pleasure of doing about 3 hours of interviews.
Did he know you were Jewish, Michael?
No, and I did not walk in wrapped in the Israeli flag. I decided that may not be the best idea. No, but he's actually quite a smart, witty man, and he's one of those people who's absolutely determined that he's right at all times. And he's, with all of his problems and the challenges he faced, he was very, very successful. I mean, that was a country that was really an agrarian economy when he came in as a prime PM in 1981, and now they're really one of the more modern economies in Asia. So for that, he does get a lot of credit.
But he did have to deal with the whole matter of a Malay ethnic minority. And this is something that we see in some other countries, but we didn't see it all that much in Asia.
Well, what's interesting about the Malaysia case is that the policies to try to produce rapid growth got mixed up in what was basically a big affirmative action program. There were great income disparities between the minority Chinese in Malaysia that tended to control most business and trading and the majority Malays, and it was a key plank of government policy to try to restore some kind of balance. And that actually where Mahathir got himself into a little bit of trouble and the government in general, where he was mixing what is basically a social agenda with an economic agenda, that didn't always work. To his credit, he realized this in the mid-'80s, late-'80s, and he made some very, very bold decisions that liberalized some of the restrictions and policies that were basically aimed at uplifting the Malays and change them in ways that produce rapid growth. And that was really a big turning point for Malaysia.
On the other hand, there seemed to be very little concern about uplifting populations in the early years. The reason many of these economies did well is that they were relying on really cheap labor. And we kept on hearing about all of these awful things that were happening to this day in some of these countries.
Yeah. Well, That is something that every country in Asia has used with great success, including Japan, is that they all capitalized on the fact that they had big pools of cheap labor that could do tasks at a fraction of the cost to what Americans and Europeans could do it at, and that's how they started raising incomes and generating wealth. In some cases, labor practices were quite severe, and labor did not have rights, and that was unfortunately a negative consequence of it. But you know, the bottom line is that the jobs that these very poor people got in factories were basically a ticket to a better life, and whatever we think of how they were treated, and it's a shame how in some cases how they were treated and continue to be treated, is that it at the same time it really did jumpstart them out of poverty.
And we wind up with Japan being a country that then had to look elsewhere for cheap labor because
right.
It had pulled itself up by its own bootstraps. Right. Why was India so late to join in on all of this?
India was late because India had and to a certain extent still has an incredibly well-entrenched economic ideology that goes back to Nehru and his team of policymakers in the 1950s. It was very much a response to India's long history of being a colony of the Great Britain. They had an idea that the international economy was biased against the emerging world, that if you participated in what was a Western-dominated trading system, that you would basically be perpetually dependent, and that the only way to correct this was to have very, very, very heavy state involvement and control of private enterprise and trade. It was actually quite a common idea in the developing world in the 1950s, 1960s. Nehru was a bit of a hero in the developing world for coming up with these systems. And it worked well in certain ways for a while, but eventually the system became so controlling, called the License Raj, where your average businessman needed government permission to do basically just about anything, introduce a new product, lay off workers, open a new factory. You couldn't really do anything without a government license. The system became so stifling that it basically started to crush itself.
It sounds like the kind of the thing that became the model for a lot of countries that maybe should have been looking to the other Asian countries, right, as a place to model themselves.
Right.
Because we've seen problems like that in Africa and in
right.
parts of South America.
That's right. What's fascinating about the early movers, the early leadership in some of the Asian countries that started their economic booms back in the 1960s is that they really went against conventional thinking. The conventional thinking in development circles at the time was that you had to detach yourself from the world economy, that the world economy was biased against you. And the leaders in Taiwan, Korea, Singapore all made the opposite choice, that our route out is through the international economy. And I actually asked this question to Lee Kuan Yew, who's the patriarch of Singapore, prime minister for a long time, and I put this question to him: I said, why were you willing to do things that other countries thought were negative and dangerous? And he kind of actually looked at me oddly, like, why are you even asking this question? Because his attitude was, okay, well, you know, we read all the theories and we knew the ideas, but, you know, I had rising unemployment and I had to create jobs and I had to get this economy going, and I was willing to use whatever methods I could get my hands on that would work. And if something didn't work, then, okay, I tossed it aside and tried something new.
My guest is Michael Shuman. His book, The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, it's published by Harper Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It's interesting that all of the countries that fueled this Asian boom then had a serious problem at a time when the two new countries, China and India, went through their boom. Were they benefiting from the fact that Japan and all those other countries were now suffering, or was it just that it was their turn?
Well, what was happening in East Asia and some of these countries that started their booms earlier in the 1950s and so 1960s is that they started to become more expensive places to do business. Wages had increased so rapidly, so fast. Incomes had gone up so at such an amazing pace that suddenly they started to have competitiveness problems. And a country like China liberalized and opened up at just the exact right moment, where businessmen in Taiwan and Hong Kong, especially in Hong Kong, South Korea, were looking for places where they could move their factories and open up new operations to regain their competitive advantage. And China opened up at just the right time, and a lot of those factories ended up moving into China.
Although China does struck me as a kind of an economic oxymoron, a capitalist communist country.
Well, that was especially true in the early days. What Deng Xiaoping did in regards to foreign investment, he realized that if China was really going to advance its economy, that it needed money, needed technology, needed management expertise, didn't have any of these things. At the same time, it was a communist state, and they were wary about suddenly throwing open the doors. So they used a concept that actually was used with great success in Taiwan in creating a special economic zone, literally putting a wall around it and saying this place has its separate laws and separate rules, and that will be very, very welcoming to foreign capital. We can use that as our kind of experiment in free capitalism and an export-oriented economy, and then we'll take it from there. And that proved to be wildly successful.
How sophisticated are these leaders as economists? India has the only trained economists as a president. None of the others really studied economics, did they? In fact, very few of them were trained in the West.
That's actually a remarkable point about the early leadership. Most of the leaders of Asian countries did not have an economics background at all. We're quite obvious. We're quite open about it. Park Chung-hee, who ruled Korea from 1961 to 79, wrote quite extensively about. He knew very little about economics. But what they And I think that to a certain extent gave them an advantage, where they didn't have ideological preconceived ideological ideas about what economy should and shouldn't do. At the same time, they were also very successful in tapping into very experienced economic talent. That's something that Suharto in Indonesia did very well, where he did have a team of economists that were trained at Berkeley that he tapped into for a lot of his policymaking ideas. So economists had great influence in Asia, but they often weren't the decision makers.
Well, the decision maker in India is Manmohan Singh, and he is a trained economist. Are we seeing the effect of that?
Well, you know, I think what has made Manmohan Singh so successful is that when he first came into office, he was actually finance minister in 1991, and he really led the reform effort in India that created their big economic boom. And he had did very classical economics training in Cambridge. And he had been kind of itching for a while to start reforming the system in India to make it more open and more outward-oriented. And I think India benefited tremendously from his experience at that moment. They needed someone to come in and put together a blueprint and say how they can get themselves out of economic crisis. And I think in that case, his economics training was absolutely crucial.
So what began the Asian crisis of the late 90s? You said that these companies had become kind of entrenched and they really were not being innovative. Is that enough of a reason? They were producing products that were selling quite well around the world.
Well, there's continued debate over what happened with the Asian economic crisis. There was a thinking at the time that came out of, say, the IMF, which was Asian policymakers and Asian companies had put in place a system at that point that had become out of date, that they weren't updating themselves from their high growth policies of the past. The companies had taken on too much debt, and the crisis was a result of the market punishing them for these types of inefficiencies. The other way of looking at it, this is the way that people like Mahathir looked at it, was that this was basically a crisis created by the international community that had invested a tremendous amount of money in Asia and then panicked and yanked it out, and that created some kind of destabilization that led to the crisis. The fact is that there's elements of truth in both of those arguments.
There are people who will tell you that the International Monetary Fund's bailouts to Asian countries sometimes had a negative effect. They were misspent and poorly allocated, and that was the IMF's problem.
The IMF put in place policies that a lot of policymakers in Asia disagree with. For example, you know, you had an economy that's basically going to a downward spiral, and the IMF insisted on hiking interest rates, which would just make more difficult for companies to pay off debts and would slow down economies even more. The IMF also did things, for example, like demand trade liberalization, which was issues that were kind of unrelated to the underlying crisis. So there was a feeling in Asia and a growing feeling today that the IMF imposed economic packages that were ideologically driven and not really designed to fix the problems that were going on the ground at that moment.
You wrote in the epilogue that you completed this book in February of this
yes.
year. A lot happened since February.
Quite a bit's happened since then.
Japan's economy has rebounded. You said that we shouldn't make too much of that. They say expect growth going forward.
They'll grow. The problem with Japan is that they never really grow very much. They tend to linger around that 1%. 1.5% mark, and they because of that they seem to be running to standstill. But I think what is fascinating about Asia, what's happened in Asia in the last 6 months, is how quickly the region in general seems to be coming out of the recession, driven to a great degree by China. Hong Kong exited its recession recently as well in the second quarter. China, India, and Indonesia are some of the fastest growing economies in the world right now. So what's interesting to watch is how even through this recession, Asia has outperformed the rest of the world and to some extent continues to gain on the United States and Europe in that way.
But since they're so dependent on exports, and right now people are buying less in the West, in the countries they export to, how can they succeed?
That's what's going on in Asia is that there's actually tremendous economic shift taking place to a great degree driven by China. When the U.S. economy fell into trouble last year, the region really panicked because the region's growth is really driven to a great degree, as you said, by exports, especially exports to the U.S. And the Chinese especially panicked. You had tens of thousands of export factories closing in China last year. And the government shifted gears really quickly. They said, okay, we have to develop some kind of domestic economy and more domestic spending to try to balance us out. And they through government stimulus and other means, and they've been very successful in doing that. And that boost that they've gotten from their domestic stimulus is driving growth around the region, is countries around the region now exporting into China.
What about the other countries, the other communist countries, Vietnam, right. Laos, Cambodia? Are they doing better?
Vietnam is a fascinating story because Vietnam is very much followed the China model in the last 7-8 years or so to become a very, very high growth country with growing foreign investment, growing exports, and you know they've struggled during the recession like everybody else. But I think they have a tremendously positive future, and there's some talk that Cambodia may actually be the next up and comer again, mainly because of low cost companies in places like Hong Kong are looking to set up new operations, and you hear the name Cambodia coming up more and more, so they could be one of the next up-and-comers.
But not Laos.
Laos is still kind of off on its doing its own thing. They
and
haven't
Myanmar
really.
And
well,
Thailand.
Myanmar is a whole other that's a whole other problem. But though Laos has not gone through the liberalization process that it needs to really kind of join the party, and Myanmar studiously avoids any kind of liberalization because of their political problems internally.
Just one more thing. A listener asked about the role of intellectual piracy in the emergence of Asian economies. Has it played a major role?
I wouldn't say a major role. It continues to be an issue, especially for foreign companies trying to do business in places like China. So I think it's more of a business issue than something that's really been a factor behind growth.
Michael Schumann is the Asia business correspondent for Time magazine and covers the entire continent from India to Japan, an area that he covers in his new book called The Miracle, The Epic Story of Asia's Quest for Wealth, which is published by Harper Business. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.